Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your alternate international cover of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
I'm waiting for the man. Hey, white boy. What you doing uptown?
As you all know, collecting, archiving, preservation, holding on to things, that's a hobby horse of mine. It's important to me. I think it's important for understanding music and how culture around music functions. We've talked about it and the importance of it recently in the episode with Hua talking about collecting. We also got into it a couple of years ago with Jody Rosen talking about the big fire at the Universal Warehouse that destroyed master recordings. This is a thing that I think about a lot. It's something that I'm mindful of as a person who doesn't want information to be lost to time and history. And Ben Cesario, who is here today. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
I know Ben cares about this as well. And Ben wrote two pieces recently on the subject about archives for Lou Reed in a show that is opening at, or that is open, I should say, at the New York Public Library. And also Bob Dylan, who has a new center hosting the Dylan Archives in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where Ben went. And given what we've been talking about on podcast and how key I think this kind of thinking is in terms of historical preservation, we're going to talk today both about the specifics of the Reed and Dylan archives and the projects that Ben wrote about, and also a little bit big picture about generational archiving and what that might mean and look like moving forward. Ben, before we get into specific details about the Reed and the Dylan thing, I almost want to offer a counter argument that's embedded in your piece or in your pieces. Okay.
Counter to what?
Counter to this whole thing that I'm advocating for, which is this kind of completest historical documentation reclamation of an artist's career and ephemera and so on and so forth. There's a quote in each of your pieces that jumped out at me as kind of being like, damn, John, you're kind of full of it, TPQH. Okay, so in your Lou Reed piece, you have a quote from Laurie Anderson, Lou's wife, and Laurie says, "This collection is to inspire people. It's not necessarily to say, here's the real Lou Reed. That's never what it was meant to be. Here's a lot of his music and how he did it. Be inspired by it. But it's not and can't be a real picture of the man." Now, obviously, what that's saying to me is this is partial. This is still at a remove. It's incomplete and potentially subtext insufficient. That's one thing. In the Dylan piece, you quote Alan Maskin, who is from the architecture and design firm that did the center. And he said, "I'm more interested in this as a living archive than as a museum. Museum implies a voice that everyone accepts as truth." Two different versions of the same notion, which is, yes, we're trying to do something quote unquote comprehensive, but really we know better. Do you think that the current impulse towards archiving and documentation in artists of this generation is kind of being simultaneously undercut by the notion that there's actually no way we'll get it full slash complete slash correct? Is that already built into the process?
I think it's kind of the idea that the asymptote will never reach the axis. You will collect all the information you can. And these archives, especially for people like Lou Reed and Bob Dylan, who are basically coming out of the 60s, and so a lot of their golden age is far in the past, the more information we have, the more yellowed, crumpled pieces of paper, the more we can learn about them. But it will never be the whole story. And the Laurie Anderson quote, think about her perspective there. She was his wife, and she knows the person in a way that you and I never could. And in fact, the Lou Reed archives are basically the stuff that he had in storage. The contents of his office, he had some sort of storage room where, like a lot of people, Dylan kind of included, they empty their pockets, they empty their files, they put them in storage, they move on. And I don't get the sense that Lou spent a lot of his time looking through his own back pages. There's all of that, but there's all for Lou and Lori, like there was their personal materials, their family photos and stuff. And so she's sort of saying, you can learn a lot about what he did and the music that he made. And there's really eye-opening stuff in the Lou Reed archive. There's new information. There's this tape from 1965 where there are incredible acoustic, basically like folk music versions of Bob Dylan versions, really, of songs that would become Velvet Underground songs.
And actually, that's what we were listening to just at the top of the show. And those are recordings that are now been, I guess, remastered. Light in the Attic is going to put them out. How important are those tapes in the kind of like Reed oeuvre? What do they tell us about what Reed was doing at that time?
They're extremely important. The Waiting for the Man snippet was actually in Todd Haynes' Velvet Underground documentary that came out last year. And that's the one where he pulled all kinds of stuff from the Andy Warhol archive. And there's all of those screen tests of members of the band. And there's a part where he's describing these weird origins of the Velvet Underground, where on one side you had John Cale and the like avant-garde drone side of it, basically avant-garde classical music. And on the other, you have Lou Reed as like the rock and roll fan. And then he introduces this element that he was also a folk music fan. And it turns out that Lou in 63, 64, he was like any other guitar playing college student. He was in Syracuse. He saw what Dylan was doing. His mind was blown. He started to imitate it, learn some of those songs, write his own songs. And when those two guys came together, they created the sound that we know as the Velvet Underground. But until this particular tape was found, that wasn't known all that well. John Cale had mentioned it, but as far as I know, there were no recordings out there that where you heard, we actually heard what it sounded like for a song like Waiting for the Man to be done in this folky Dylan-esque form. And that blew my mind when I saw the movie last year. And I was really happy to hear that, you know, it's in the show at the library and Light in the Attic is putting it out. There's very detailed liner notes and everything. So I do think this is a good example of archives, which can sound just like an intimidating thing of boxes and boxes of paper, actually contributing something important to the body of knowledge that even ordinary fans can just like dial into and really get something out of.
We were talking a little bit when we were texting about this last week, I think, about it's also like a healthy reminder that these folks, and maybe you talk about this in one of the two pieces, I can't remember which, these are folks who had curated public presentations. There are parts of the backstory or parts of the process that were deliberately obscured. You are a pop star or a pop performer of that era, you're not going to reveal everything that went into the sauce to get you there. And so one of the interesting things is both, obviously, Lou Reed's not with us anymore. Bob Dylan's old enough that he probably doesn't care. But at a certain point, you just allow people to look at all that stuff and without fearing that it's going to derail your very carefully cultivated public presentation.
Archives as an institution, something that universities collect and scholars sift through, that basically comes out of literary archives. And so the model there is, okay, what letter did F. Scott Fitzgerald write to his publisher telling them what he wanted to do for his next book? I just think that's a very different type of artistry than a pop music creator. Even for somebody like Dylan or Lou Reed, who had very conscious literary ambitions, that they really saw what they were doing as importing literary work into pop music, they were still performers. Like part of what they did is just, as you said, curate a sort of public face for what they were all about. And so Lou Reed is interesting because he comes under the wing of Andy Warhol. That's all about the surface presentation. And Lou would often talk about the lessons that he learned from Andy and about never tell the truth to the media. Just tell a story.
Don't get any ideas, performers. Tell us the truth. Don't get any ideas. Y'all not Andy Warhol out here. Just tell me the truth. Okay, sorry, keep going.
So he just had this like irascible public persona, and that's part of what we liked about him. That's part of what we love about Lou Reed. but it's not the whole person. And one of the things that was funny to me interviewing Lori and the archivists that have been working on this and other people is like, there's a sentimental side of Lou Reed that you'll hear about from his insiders, which is like when he listened to a piece of music that he really liked and that affected him emotionally, he would roll up his sleeves and show the goosebumps. And he would like point to the tears beginning to pour down his cheek. And you didn't really see that in public too much. I mean, I remember one time I went to a reading where Lou was reading from his lyric collection book and he was signing it. And the person there was like, okay, the rule here is you can take a photo, but no flash. So like he starts signing books and like the very first person to take a picture, the flash goes off and Lou like slams the book shut and just is like signing over. That's what we think of as Lou Reed, but there's obviously more to him. And so I think that's part of what Lori Anderson was getting at is just that like the archives are our scraps are like our breadcrumbs of like how he created some of his work and random stuff too, like his petty cash receipts from being on tour where he kept everything totally unnecessarily. But they don't tell you like who the human being was.
Okay, so let's stay focused on the Reed stuff for now. We'll get to the Dylan stuff. You mentioned that they are different in terms of what's available or what's on display. And obviously, the Dylan thing is in a permanent home. The Reed thing is in a temporary exhibit. The nature of the Reed collection, and again, I think this is sort of what Lori's getting at, there's just so much ephemera in the collection. Is the Reed stuff maybe less considered than the Dylan stuff?
Considered? What do you mean?
I like to think that I hold on to things that are important to me and will have meaning or have some kind of use and then get rid of the rest. That's what I mean by considered. Was there a vetting process at some point 30 years ago, 40 years ago, or is this just literally everything that got thrown in the storage unit?
I think in both cases, it's everything that survived. I think that at least in the case of Lou Reed and Bob Dylan, I don't know how considered they were, the artists, about what they were saving and what they were chucking away. And it may have been that for them, it was no different to chuck something in the garbage as to chuck it in a box. And one of the interesting things about the Lou Reed collection is there's nowhere near what you want from the early Velvet Underground days. There was that tape, which has a very special story that we can go into if you want. But like there do not exist a lot of typewritten lyrics for the classic Velvet Underground songs. Either he didn't keep them, or they were stolen or thrown away, or somebody snatched them many years ago and they're on their wall. This is sort of known to the people who are in the business of selling memorabilia. There's just not a lot there. And there was a story about the woman who worked for Lou Reed, I think, as a tour manager in the 70s. And her name was Barbara. I don't remember what her last name is, but her name is signed on a lot of the receipts. And apparently, like, she would go somewhere with Lou. He would write lyrics down on a piece of paper. And then he would go into the studio, record the song, and then he'd throw away the piece of paper. Mm. And she would say, like, no, Lou, keep that. So to some extent, sure, he was keeping something that was important to him. But I think there's a lot that just ends up by default, partly because of the business management that surrounds those people. In the case of both Lou and Bob Dylan, there were lawsuits involving managers, possibly record companies, where things get preserved because they're part of legal cases.
Discovery.
And so they're discovery. And so like they go in a box, the box goes to the lawyer. And then maybe 10 years later, the lawyer's office sends it back and the current manager of the artist says, like, just put this in the storage room. And Dylan, this is partly what sources have told me and partly sort of my guess, but that with Dylan, there is a very sort of interesting timeline of him poking into his archives, him pulling things in order to do commercial projects that basically goes back to sometime in the late 60s. Where he records all these songs with the band, they get bootlegged. He was basically like the first artist to be bootlegged in the way that we think of that now. And then eventually he tried to disrupt the bootleggers. He put out the Basement Tapes.
And you talk about this in the Dylan piece, where basically Dylan is the first person to do that, but also not simply to do it as a defensive maneuver against the bootleggers, but also to inherently understand and profit off of the value of the material that may have been thought of as the cast-offs previously, to just implicitly understand, actually, this has value too, not simply the finished product, but the...
But it was the bootleggers who taught him that.
Right, but he's just the first to adopt it for himself.
And this is also the period where, there's a famous story of the guy who rooted through Dylan's garbage. And this is actually the person who invented the word Dylanology, that we now think of as the, you know, art and science of understanding Bob Dylan. In fact, it's just going through his garbage to get any scrap of trivia. And so the world was telling Bob Dylan that, look, every piece of garbage that you create has some value, literally a value, and other people are going to exploit it if you don't. So there's the Basement Tapes. In the 80s, there was his box set called Biograph, which is a very interesting product because it was kind of one of the first archival box sets. It wasn't just greatest hits. It has unknown tracks, alternate takes. It has a lot of detailed information. And so it's kind of this little box that you can sort of poke through as a fan to learn here's some stuff I didn't quite know. And it's also a way to monetize fans, because even if they've bought the 25 previous albums, there's going to be a reason for them to buy this. Then Dylan does his own bootleg series, which has been going on for 30 years, where basically he's releasing outtakes, the Martin Scorsese film, etc. So there's been this long process where Dylan, or at least the people who work for him, have had this reason to start going through the archives, organizing stuff, even taking that crumpled up piece of paper and saying, you know what, let's keep that. That might be something someday. And my assumption, and I don't know it for sure, because I don't know what obviously was going on in his mind, but I think that's kind of how the Dylan archive ended up as the mountain of material that it is now, as opposed to maybe he would have just chucked a lot of it over the years and only kept the things that are really sentimental and important to him. He's not really shown any interest, Dylan, in going through this stuff himself. He'll never talk about it. He doesn't care.
You mentioned in your piece on the Dylan Center that he performed recently in Tulsa and didn't even mention the fact that he's five blocks away from the Dylan Center. But I like the idea. It's almost like you're sending a doppelganger out on the road to do twice the work. You know what I mean? It's you do your tour, the doppelganger does the other tour, you cover more territory. It does have that feel of Dylan's my job is forward looking. My job is to continue to make new things. That's what I want to do. I don't want to live in the past, but I understand that there's value, that people are attracted to that stuff. So let me give that its own life, and it can go on the road, metaphorically, although it's obviously staying in one place. Ratings froze. Get your mind off wind. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. You ain't going nowhere.
I'm Wesley Morris. I'm a culture writer at the New York Times, where I co-host a podcast called Still Processing. Normally, I do this work with the incomparable Jenna Wortham, but this season, Jenna is off writing a book. So I invited some of my favorite writers and critics to come talk to me about the culture that shaped us, the changing ways we consume it, and why Keanu Reeves is basically a culture unto himself. You can listen to Still Processing wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with Ben Cesario, music business reporter at the Times, and Dylan Reedologist. Can you talk to me about the experience of visiting Tulsa, seeing the place, seeing the center? How is the stuff displayed? How interactive is it? I looked at a lot of the handwriting and the photos that we ran with the piece. The handwriting's chicken scratch. It's tough to look at. What are the enhancements like? What's the tactile experience of seeing all of this material in person?
I think it's pretty state of the art, I have to say. My natural reporter's skepticism was, when I was going into it, like, you know, how are they going to turn a bunch of yellow pieces of paper into an interesting exhibit and something that will appeal to people who are not Dylan nuts? But I was really pleasantly surprised. The museum is quite interactive, and there actually was a great deal of work that went into designing it. Some of the people who did the Bowie, David Bowie Is exhibit, which was extremely interactive and almost kind of cinematic in spots, they worked on this. Alan Maskin, the architect you mentioned, he's also kind of a specialist in designing exhibits. You know, these are very high profile people who really do the best work in the field on this. And so when you walk in, the first thing you see is this room with actually a couple props in it. I got to say, that was one of my first disappointments. Was you walk in and there's this old piano with sheet music on it, and there's a manual typewriter with a William Burroughs stuff flying out of it. Those weren't actually Dylan's piano and typewriter. They're just props. But surrounding it on three walls are projections of various videos. Some of it is from the Martin Scorsese film, No Direction Home, from the 90s. It's like a 2-hour documentary or so, but there were many hours of interviews that were filmed. And so you see some of that. So you see a lot of Dylan talking, you see a lot of his friends, associates, other musicians, and they're sort of all over the place. And that feels a bit cool and futuristic. Then you walk into a room in which there's, along the sides, is a pretty typical museum chronological display showing photos and artifacts and having text on little shingles explaining things. But then in the center of the room, they've chosen 6 songs to focus on, and they delve into them. They do have lyrics. I thought that some of the stuff they did in illuminating lyric books was pretty amazing. They take the song Joker Man, which there are something like 17 drafts. And these are ones where some are written, some are typed. In some spots, they hardly change from draft to draft. In others, they change a lot. And there's this big touch screen that highlights certain passages on each draft and shows you how they changed from one to the next. And if you tap it in certain spots, it'll show how, like, that line changed 10 times. You tap it in a different spot, it shows a different line. There are ways to kind of put them all together. I thought that was very instructive. And to me, it's also just amazing to see the work that went into it. I think that is just the most basic takeaway, is that Bob Dylan did not just sit down at a typewriter, bang out lyrics in one piece of paper and sing it, and that's the song. Most of the time, that was not what he did. And in some of these songs, there's 30, 40 drafts. That is pretty cool to see.
Dylan and Reed are people who at least orient themselves in relationship to, or potentially in relationship against, the poets, the literary scene of their time. And so you have two artists here who very much, my feeling is, see themselves as doing a form. Again, I don't want to get the Dylanologists all up in my ass about this, but, like, you know, a form of literature, and this intense revision process is certainly familiar to me, and I'm sure to you and any other writer. This is the work. The work is the revision. It's the writing, but it's also the revision. Dylan is perhaps the most famous person in pop music history in terms of flaunting this kind of work and showing the evolution. Is that fair to say?
Maybe. I don't think the extent of it was known until this archive happened, but, like, certainly he's somebody that the whole, like, this is the fifth alternate take of Keep It In Mind or whatever. Yeah, that's a fair thing to say, I think.
Can you tell me a little bit about ways in which the Reed archive and the Dylan archive differ in terms of both the material that's in the archives, but also the nature of revelation contained within?
In both cases, they're very big. Dylan's archive is, I think, much bigger.
You're only seeing a slice when you go. You're only seeing a slice, obviously.
Yeah. When you go to the exhibition, you're certainly only seeing a slice. In the case of Dylan, I've now written 2 pieces about the archive and spent you know, a decent amount of time looking at it. And I've only seen the tip of the iceberg. I do know from talking to people and from what's already out there that there is information there that sort of changes the story. Clinton Halen is like very prominent Dylan scholar, and his most recent book basically goes into at the very beginning, like he was working on a Dylan book and then he had to like start over once the news broke in my story about the Dylan archive. And so I think in the case of Dylan, they're kind of lowercase revelations. There's information about how he wrote songs. I think the biggest takeaway about the work that went into it, I think, was probably guessable, but I don't think anybody realized quite the extent. Lou Reed, there's less material. A lot of it is audiovisual, which is pretty cool. And in that case, I think a lot of it was known but forgotten about, or I'm not sure how much had been in the public record for anyone to examine. For example, one of his tours in the 70s, he had the back of the stage was filled with TV screens that were playing like static and visual feedback and had this kind of future dystopia look to it as he played. They have the films that he used to create this. He actually shot on film, he shot his own TV as it played what he called feedback. And it's basically just like static and weird shapes on his cathode ray TV. And then he stacked them up and played them. And they have a small recreation of that. And that stuff was sort of known to super fans and scholars. And when it comes to Lou Reed and the Velvet Underground, there are a lot of those people. But I'm a big Lou fan and I didn't know about that. I didn't see his 1976 tour.
Why not?
Yeah. I could have. I was alive.
You were a lazy baby, Ben. A lazy baby.
I don't have the greatest answer about like how much new information do they have for us, because I don't know what all of the old information was. And I haven't spent 6 months going through everything that they have. But we already know that there's cool, odd stuff that has popped up. And I just think a lot about like how big of a deal archival releases are generally. There are a lot of artists that you can tell put a great deal of work into it. I mean, Neil Young is probably the biggest example. He owns his own archive and he is well known to have like employed people for many decades to keep it all. And his website, Neil Young Archives, got famous in the Joe Rogan episode as being the place where he would just spout off about things. But the purpose of that website is to house his audio archives, and you can subscribe to it. And he has released, I don't even know how many albums at this point, of albums that he made and never released or changed, his live recordings. Those are like thoroughly and carefully curated and documented. I was also just thinking about like Light in the Attic, like we mentioned, and Numero Group and others. There are labels now whose business model is doing very detailed, well-curated archival releases of artists often that were like basically forgotten about.
I feel like my future job is doing the Numero Group for like Raw Shack Records from 1998. I feel like that's like when I'm like 68 years old, I'm going to be like going through my old vinyl and being like, we should really put this out in 16 channel audio or whatever.
I think it's interesting, though, that like those labels in the big picture, their model is telling an alternate history of pop music. This is the stuff that did not get the notice when it happened 40 or 50 or 60 years ago. And these stories along the fringes of pop music tell us something. And some of those are like R&B groups. Some of them are from foreign countries. Like there's all this like psych rock from Turkey and the film about Cambodian pop music that got snuffed out by the Khmer Rouge. And so there are sort of like many stories in the world that essentially got crowded out by the Bob Dylans of the world. So I feel like the challenge for a Dylan archive is to kind of tell us something we don't already know. And that's sort of happening, that the amount of material that is there to be examined, to be studied, is sort of turning out new information. And a lot of the people who write about this seriously are finding that the Beatles is another example of this. some of the more recent work that's gone into writing about the Beatles has sort of like rewritten many of the assumptions that came out that were essentially propaganda, right? When they were just like a pop band putting out press releases and being in teen magazines. Once the actual deep historical research can be done, there are changes to that narrative. I mean, we saw that with the Get Back movie. The story always told was that they were miserable making this album. They hated it. Turns out they actually were having a good time. They were just doing something that was basically impossible. And the film that now exists of it, or the film that has now been released, tells a story that couldn't have been told at the time.
Now, you know me. You specifically know me. And you know that this is not my, Dylan and Reed is not my kind of like centrist area of concern or interest or fandom. If I'm walking in to either of these exhibits, either of these archival centers, how much am I getting of the kind of basic narrative that's not geared towards the super fan, the super dedicated researcher? How much is on display that tells, in essence, the bio, the entry level stuff? Or is that basically totally skipped over in favor of the deep cuts, the ephemera, so on and so forth?
It's a good question. I think at the Dylan Center, they don't like to call it a museum, but at the Dylan Center in Tulsa, you will get a lot of the familiar bio. And part of that is because I think the familiar bio is not all that wrong when it comes to Dylan about just his evolution as an artist. You may get it in more accurate detail than you would have if you were reading The Village Voice and Rolling Stone in the 70s. Reed, I'm not so sure. It's tough for me to say because I feel like part of what they're doing there is not just telling a simple narrative. It is more of an advertisement for what they have at the library. And it's kind of like, here's a bunch of really cool stuff. So I think if you were coming in there as a Martian, there would be some pretty cool stuff. But I don't know if you would say, wow, this is the story of a life. I don't think you would necessarily see that.
And it's worth qualifying. So the Reed exhibit, like you say, it's almost an advertisement for the archive, and that archive is available to the public, correct?
Yes, and that's a very big difference between the two of them. The Dylan archive is inaccessible. You need to apply with credentials. They don't let anybody just go in and look. But the Lou Reed collection is part of the New York Public Library, a public institution, and like you can just literally go in there and write down the card catalog number or whatever the classification system is. And they'll bring out box number 45. And like, you can see the letter from Bono and the letter from John Cale, the letter from Jimmy Page. You can actually handle that stuff yourself.
Very frightening, TBH. I will say, when I die, give my scattered post-it notes to the public library, please. Don't lock them away in Tulsa. But anyway, please continue.
People have found stuff in the Lou Reed archive at the library.
And when you say that, what does that mean? Because I guess when you said that in your piece, what I was trying to figure out was, did they not go through everything before they put it in the archive? Do they not have a sense of what's in there? You're suggesting that amateur Reed scholars or fans have discovered or stumbled onto unanticipated things. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's nutty.
They went through a lot of it. But there are hundreds and hundreds of hours of audio, and there are lots of like unlabeled cassettes and reel-to-reel tapes and so forth. There are labels that are wrong. I know that they digitized all of the tapes, or maybe they're still in the process. I can't remember. They've digitized it. They haven't necessarily gone through every minute. And one of the librarians was telling me there's a lot of video and they have to go through it and digitize it and catalog it. And like, it's laborious because he does Sweet Jane like 500 times on tour. And like, it's just a lot to sit there and go through. And they have a whole library to run. So for example, there's a person who was a friend of Lou and Lori who is working with Lori on a book about Lou's Tai Chi, his whole interest in Tai Chi. He created music about it and so forth. They were playing a tape at the library, and like somewhere on that tape, a cassette tape, there's a song that's not listed on the in the cataloging system. And it turns out that the song is about Tai Chi. And so the few people whose job it was to like put this all together and say 325 60-minute tapes in boxes A, B, and C, I guess they just didn't get to that one. And so there is stuff like that. The other thing was like when they were going through it, because, you know, this is a working artist who is just thinking about putting out music and isn't necessarily taking like proper notes on everything that they do. There's a reel-to-reel tape that they assumed was a demo for Metal Machine Music. Turns out it was from years before. And it sort of shows that what ultimately became Metal Machine Music was sort of gestated for many years, like a decade or so. Who knows how often he came to it, but he's doing a version of that in like 65 or 66. And there was, I got to tell you, John, there was one edit that killed me in the piece, which was they were explaining sort of how they figured out that this one tape was from the 60s and not from the 70s. And it was that at the end of this reel of tape, there's a piano piece that plays. And they figured out by comparing it to various other tapes that it was John Cale playing the piano, a particular piano in a particular place. And so they were able to determine that. And they said that on one of these pieces of audio, there's a single voice that you hear saying one word, and it's naughty.
Whoa.
It's Nico. There's a, you know, Germanic low female voice saying the word naughty. And like when they heard it, like they knew that it was her. Turned out in the fact-checking process, that was one of the other pieces of audio that they compared it to, not the one that they were trying to date. So I cut it from the piece, but it was a bummer, not to mention the Nico naughty audio research project there. I know you will sympathize. I know you will sympathize with me on that.
Absolutely. But I'm glad that you got it in on podcast, which is perhaps the more important place to get it. Okay. Can I pivot to a little bit of a philosophical conundrum as we are heading to the finish line?
Yes.
Okay. In reading your pieces and in thinking about Bob Dylan's unopened fan mail and Lou Reed's petty cash receipts, all I could think about was how no artist that I care about for the last like 20 years probably has any of this stuff. Whether it's because stuff doesn't exist, because there's no physical fan mail, or because people expect there to be kind of digital cloud archives of things. And I'm sure, as you know, the cloud is not to be trusted. Certainly things can get disappeared. Things could be trapped in formats, digital formats that are hard to recover. We've already seen generations of music that was posted on the internet in old formats that it's either gone or hard to access. The Reed Dylan archival project, projects broadly speaking, is this just a moment that will never be recreated because it's very particular to an era of musician and a style of musician? It's the particular kind of self-conception that artists of that generation had. They held on to certain things, but that's not that likely to be replicated down the line. I'm a person that holds on to everything, but I don't think a lot of the artists I care about are holding on to all this stuff. I could be wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that there's an NBA Youngboy research center that has all his expense reports. Like, I hope so. But my guess is maybe not. Does something feel specifically generational about this? And do you have anxiety about this not being available for artists from the 80s, artists from the 90s, and artists from the 2000s?
Yeah, I thought a lot about it. And I think I basically agree with you that there was something particular about this generation of artists, people who wrote on paper, typed on typewriters, recorded on physical tape, have acetates of their records, took Polaroids, that kind of stuff. So I think like clearly, just as a society, we're sort of moving past that, and that younger artists will have less of that material. I don't think it's gone, though. Think about Kanye writing down the set list for Pablo or something. Like, it's still there. And I have to imagine that somebody around Kanye is stashing that stuff.
It better be.
Netflix documentary
better be.
Shows us that. I mean, in that case, like there was films, right? There were basically like films of him working and stuff. And that's valuable archival data. But yeah, I do think that something is kind of lost when there's no longer fan mail, when it's Instagram comments.
And again, I feel like once or twice a year on Popcast, I have this like call out into the void for digital archivists. But like, people do need to save Instagram comments. Like, that is, you're right. That is the fan mail of 2020s, of the 2020s. People need to save that. People need to be archiving it. That stuff gets deleted. I want to know that. I mean, I'm finding this even with my Kanye stuff, where like, sometimes the only copy of an old digital artifact is not an official copy. It's something that someone at some point, a person on the internet, randomly saved and held on to, and then maybe posted for sharing amongst dedicated fans. But it's like, you're really out here wikiing history in a real way, and it's unsettling. I personally find it unsettling.
Yeah, I just think it's a strange paradox where like the physical materials of archives may be disappearing, but there may be much greater opportunities for digital archives. And think about Joe's Diary of a Song, where he's got people's voice memos of them creating songs. And there was something that came out of the Ed Sheeran copyright trial in England recently, where it was like, because he has been accused of stealing other people's songs when he was creating his own songs, he now films all of his recording sessions. He films them to prove, if he needs to, hey, when I was in the studio, I came up with that melody myself. Thank you very much. Case dismissed. So there are going to be tremendous opportunities to capture that information. I think the question that we're asking is like, does that digital ephemera become even more ephemeral if the format only lasts a decade? The Instagram comment is one thing. What about the MySpace?
Oh, yeah.
Like, that wasn't even that long ago. And so if the idea is that the comments on Fall Out Boy's MySpace page, do they still exist? Like, that must be valuable material to explain a period of pop music history in the, like, the recent past. So does that still exist? I don't know. I don't think it's going to be as fun to look through as like yellowed pieces of TypeScript lyrics.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe,
man,
it's just my age, but like, that's pretty fun. That's pretty fun.
I think I'm going to get a kick. If somebody, okay, this is an open call. If somebody wants to dump old MySpace comments from Kanye West's MySpace, somebody just wants to Dropbox those to me, I will take as much joy in that as Ben does in looking through yellowed old pieces of paper at the Dylan and Lou Reed archives. That's all I'm going to say. Throwing it out there. Ben, I appreciate this as always, a fellow traveler into the dustbins of the past. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Hell, download and save every podcast ever, because Lord knows what the hell the next distribution platform is going to be. Pedro, we got to have a zip file, just something to keep in mind, of all the episode audios. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, etc. Get on the Facebook group, get in the Discord. Email us at podcastnytimes.com. If you have any unusual archival information, let me and Ben know. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We'll be back next week. This is Bob Dylan, Joker Man, whichever, draft number 39.
It's a shadowy world. Skies are slippery gray. A woman just gave birth to a prince today, and she's dressed in scarlet. Held her peace in the pimps that make old men. Could have been Joan of Arc.